Hi, I'm Jane Leader, and you're listening to Older Women and Friends. You know, we older women have a lot to say about love, grief, loss, and resilience. We're more comfortable speaking our truth. We've been good scouts and earned our badges, and now it's time to change the perception that the gig is just about up, when in truth, the second wave of the gig has just begun. We are the matriarchs, the women at the top of the food chain, and we've been given the precious gift of passing along the wisdom that we fought so hard for. So let's build a community of older women, women who are strong, self-fulfilled, and a hell of a lot of fun. Hello, I am so happy today to welcome Ilana Landsberg-Lewis. She has more creds than most people I know, so I'll just list a few. She is a labor and human rights lawyer in Canada. She's a passionate women's rights advocate, and she is now the host of the podcast, Wisdom at Work, Older Women, Elder Women, and Grandmothers on the Move. And because many of us are grandmothers, wannabe grandmothers, grandmothers in waiting, Ilana seemed like absolutely the perfect person to talk to. How are you today?
I'm well, Jane. How are you?
I'm doing just great. Thank you. After a few technological hiccups, I'm doing much better. I'm going to ask you something that maybe other people don't when they're doing a traditional interview. And I would love you to tell us a little bit about your childhood.
Oh, that is interesting. People rarely ask me about that. Well, I had an unusual childhood in some respects. I had a very happy and active and supportive family. My mother is and was a feminist journalist in the National Press in Canada. So I was breastfed on feminism and a sense of self from a very, very young age, and a sense of possibility, a limitless possibility. And my father, who was involved in the equivalent of the Labour Party in Canada, was in politics and a human rights activist and humanitarian. And he often joked that my mother made him a human being and brought him up too, because he was always had an egalitarian instinct, but he's also a very ardent feminist. And so in my household, I have a brother and a sister. Our dinner table conversations were filled with raucous laughter and a lot of love and mutuality, but also a pretty adult conversation from the time I was very young, because both my parents were engaged in sort of the social justice project of making the world a better place. And we were just involved in those conversations. So whatever my mother was writing about, if it was about children's rights or women's rights, or particular issues that were happening in the day, whatever my father was debating in Parliament in Ontario, in the province where we live, that was the fodder for conversation. So that, along with all the normal things of childhood for progressive family living in an urban environment, was a pretty rich childhood.
Sounds like it. So my next question, of course, would be, were your grandparents on either sides or both in the picture?
They were, very importantly, actually, in my own life and my own development. My grandfather on my mother's side, my maternal grandfather, he had passed away when I was just a year old, so I didn't grow up with him. But my mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, I was very close with her. And she was a most unusual person in some ways. She was very proper. She had been smuggled out of Russia after the First World War, and they came through England to Canada. They were Jewish. And so she was very proper. She was trying to fit in sort of colonial Canada. She was more... She wasn't British identified, but she was very proper. She sometimes wore gloves to dinner, and she made me walk with books on my head and practice diction. But she wasn't strict. She was a very gentle and loving and very non-judgmental person. So she was a lovely influence in my life. And on my father's side, my paternal grandfather was also involved in what is the equivalent of the Labour Party in Canada, the third party here. And very political and very involved with the union movement here, which is very strong. And so he too helped raise me in the spirit of social justice. And he's the one who said to me when I was 10 years old, if you want to understand how power works and you want to understand how to participate in the project of making the world a better place, you should go to law school and learn how laws work. I was 10 years old, and he was just such a, he was also a very gentle and loving person. And I never forgot it, Jane. And I ended up going to law school because he said to me, the end never justifies the means, but the means will always shape the end. And I never forgot it.
Wow, what a lucky woman you are to have had such a strong, loving childhood and so much support. Did they live close by?
Close enough. My grandmother, who I was close with, lived quite close by, so I saw her regularly. My paternal grandparents lived in Ottawa, which is a 5-6 hour drive from Toronto, so we didn't see each other all the time, but enough. And I lost all my grandparents sort of between the age of 15 and 16. So it was sad because it was premature in terms of, you know, I would have loved to have had them around much longer, of course, but long enough that they were a powerful influence and sort of supportive cushion and underpinning foundation to my life. So, yeah, they were good.
You talked about one of your grandmothers who made you walk around with, did you say, books on your head, etc. So that paints somewhat of a picture of her. I wonder if you can think of a special episode or event that might give us a better idea of your other grandmother.
To be fair to my maternal grandmother, she also went speed skating, and she also was a wonderful fisherwoman and loved to fish, as well as making tea, and probably the best Jewish cook or cook of Jewish traditional food that I've ever known. She was renowned for her cooking and then became a real estate agent after her husband died, and people loved her for her gentleness and her, but she had it. She was a tough cookie when she needed to be, which was wonderful. My other grandmother was more challenging for me. She was smart as a whip. She was up to date on all things political and all things sort of worldly. But she had had a harder life. You know, she had lost her mother in Poland, White Russia, when she was quite young, and was in a pretty traditional Jewish family, and so pretty oppressive in terms of her own aspirations for freedom and free thought, and took care of the family, and then left at a pretty young age with my grandfather to emigrate to Canada, where, of course, you know, in her generation, her smarts and her engagement with the world was limited by the gender roles of the time and the gender limitations. And so I think that grandmother, as I get older, I empathize actually quite a bit with what must have been quite frustrating. Her husband, my grandfather, was a Rhodes Scholar, and so went to Oxford when he was quite young. They came over on a boat, and he taught himself how to speak English from the old curiosity shop by Dickens, so that he had a lilting accent that people thought was Welsh, but in fact, he was just an old world Russian Jew. And my grandmother went with him to Oxford, but of course, she wasn't allowed to live on campus. So she lived off campus, and all these young men who were having this wonderful education would come, and she would do their laundry and listen to them. And she participated in conversation because she was exceptionally bright. But I think what I picked up on most as a youngster was her deep frustration and I think dissatisfaction with her lot in life. She would have been able to do so much more had there been more equality at the time.
Right. I was going to ask you how your opinion has changed. I know when we're young, I'm not sure exactly what we judge people on, maybe the way they talk, the way they react to us emotionally, physically. And then, of course, so we have one opinion. And then, as you said, as you get older, so how did you see your grandmothers when you were younger?
Well, that's an interesting question in my case, Jane, because I come from, and I think not a unique background by any means, but unusual in the sense that my parents were engaged in this sort of social justice project in life. So there was so much engagement with us as the children around issues of the day and human rights and social justice, etc. And so my grandparents were a very interesting counterpoint to that. It's not that they weren't, but they provided something quite different. My maternal grandmother, she had a, I was a very, very, believe it or not, but I was a very shy child.
No, I don't believe it.
Yeah, I was exceptionally shy. And I actually, very few people heard me speak before the age of about 20, even. I whispered. I was very, very shy. So my maternal grandmother, who had a very quiet, accepting way about her, was a real haven for me. She was lovely, and she embraced me for who I was. And not that my parents didn't, quite the opposite, they did, but she created a kind of quiet and loving space. And we would cook together, and we would make tea and drink tea and read together. And it was, I really adored her. And I learned a lot about the balance between a kind of human gentleness in the way that we relate to people and the gumption and the rigor and the vigor that you need to have when you want to work to improve the human condition, right? So there was, for me, it was a lovely balance between my grandmother and the rigor of the family I was growing up in, which I loved and had to find my own way. My other grandparents, I think, were also a counterpoint, but I think what I really learned from them, watching them, was how important that generational difference could be. So my grandparents on my father's side spoke Yiddish to each other, but they wouldn't teach it to me. And my brother and I both asked them to teach us Yiddish, and they were absolutely would not teach it to us. It was the new country, and yet they spoke beautiful Yiddish, and their adult children, my parents and my father's siblings, also spoke Yiddish, but the grandchildren were not to learn it. So I think I learned in a very deep way some of the intergenerational trauma and fear, but also just how do you communicate across completely different experiences. I didn't know it when I was young. As I got older, I thought more and more about it.
And you mentioned earlier, you sort of anticipated one of my questions, which is, how did being one of your grandmothers and how did being a woman affect what she could and could not do, what her life ended? I know, for example, I have a grandmother no longer, but she wanted to be an artist. She was a painter. She didn't really want to be a mother, and yet she was never given that opportunity. And I felt her terrible frustration and anger, and, you know, it affected her personality and her relationship with me. So I'm wondering about the grandmother who, because she was a woman, for example, with your grandfather as a Rhodes Scholar, and that she was not allowed to live on campus. How did that feel to you, or were you too young to really grasp that significance until older?
It's a really interesting question. I think I did grasp it because I was growing up in a feminist family. But what's interesting, Jane, is that my father's mother, I'm not sure I could interpret the frustration as frustration. I don't think at a young age, I really understood what was the friction that I was picking up on, or what was the static, the noise that I knew was there. Because my grandfather was a politician and in the public eye, he was traveling across the country by train because there wasn't a lot of money back then. And so to organize farm workers and union workers across the country, he would travel by train. So he was gone for long periods of time. He was also a labor lawyer. And so for my grandmother, she was left alone with four kids a lot of the time. And so by the time I came along and all the kids were adults, I knew that there was something, because she didn't always seem to me to be a very happy person. It wasn't that she acted unhappy, because she didn't, but she did. There was more friction, and I didn't always know what that was. Mind you, because my grandfather was in the public eye, she was also often in the public eye and around reporters and whatnot, and they loved her. She was an incredible listener, and she would ask them stories about themselves and all the people, because they were in politics. As a politician's wife, she was extraordinary listener and showed great deep interest in people's lives, gave them advice. So I also heard stories from other people about how much they admired her and how much she made them feel heard and seen. So I had different views of my grandmother being filtered all the time. It was actually a wonderful thing to grow up with. It was complex, wasn't easy.
Now, I know that you have traveled extensively and that you have spent time with women and grandmothers all over the world. And I know you have some very good stories to tell, and I think we'd like to hear a few of them. And I think I know the answer to this before even asking, but what's the difference between the way that elder women are treated in some of the other countries that you visited and the way that they're treated here? When I say here, I assume we're talking Canada as well as the
North
United
America.
States.
Sure, yeah. North America. You know, Jane, no one has ever asked me that question. And I want to think about my answer very carefully because there are more similarities than differences, I think. And I don't think that's the expected answer because we generally think of other countries as not having the same rights, the same standard of living always that we have. When we think about the middle class in North America, obviously. But I think actually that what I have learned, which has really moved me and impressed itself upon me, is that there is an extraordinary universality. And I'm not to generalize, but to sort of point out the commonality, which is very interesting, the universality of older women who feel, of course, this isn't everyone, it's always wrong to say, to generalize, but a commonality of older women who feel like they're not being heard, they don't have the same relevance that they had when they were young, whether it was in their working lives or as mothers or in whatever incarnation they had as younger women, that they're sort of cast aside very often, that there's a divide between generations that used to be sort of a respect and deference for your elders, but now is much less, more relational, less about sort of respect. And I think that I hear that from older women, elder women, grandmothers all over the world. And I think the other thing that I hear, which I think is an important thing to heed, is that almost all of the older women that I have the privilege to work with and speak to have so much to contribute, have a continuity of experience. You know, we've been living through this pandemic, but so many of the older women that I know lived through polio, lived through other kinds of health crises and sort of global fears or crises at home, and have some real knowledge and coping skills and thoughts about how you get through these really calamitous moments, and at the same time are not being consulted, are not being talked to. I think the one other thing I would draw a parallel is that I think it's true for all of the older women and grandmothers that I speak to, I still have yet so much to give from wherever they are, in whatever position they are, economically, in terms of ability, in terms of access. Every single older woman and grandmother I've ever met with had much more to give, was not yet finished the project of life, whether it was looking after grandchildren while their daughters were working, whatever it was, looking after, raising children whose parents had died of AIDS in Africa, which is a lot of my work in the past. And so the other commonality was that I think there is we're losing something in our society by not paying attention to the fact that every older woman I've ever spoken to has much, much more to do and to say and to accomplish. And it needs to be given that space.
Well, your answer did surprise me, and it wasn't one that I anticipated. I anticipated that you were going to talk about the intergenerational situations in other countries, the fact that grandparents are living with their sons or daughters. I expected that the idea of a wise old woman was one that carried a lot of weight. And yet you're telling me that in effect, and very sadly in effect, that there are these commonalities between older women, elder women, grandmothers across the world.
I think that's right. And I do think that you're right to point out, though, that in North America, and again, generalizing is always problematic, but there's a general sense in North America that the older, wise woman in the village, the wiser woman in our communities, that venerable position has really been eroded and has not been uplifted in the way that it has in some other cultures. And I do think that it is true that in a lot of communities in other countries, there is much more of an affinity and connection and language around ancestors, around elders. And I think that a lot of us in North America, not all, because there's extraordinary diversity in, between and amongst communities, but a lot of us have lost that. And I think that we have a lot to learn from those who have preserved that intergenerational exchange.
And how do we go about learning that from our own grandparents? People in my age group have more than likely, of course, they've lost all their grandparents. Mine would be, I don't know, 130. It's, you know, it's, I can't calculate it. You know, what do we do? How do we start to bridge the gap? How do we begin to help younger people understand the value? There's a quote that I found in, I don't know if you know Ashton Applewhite's book, The Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And she quotes someone who said, "It is insane to look at an aging population and not rejoice."
Well, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, right? That
I think a lot of the discussion, and there's much more now than there used to be around ageism and what we lose when ageism is at work in our families, in our communities, in our society. I think that's wonderful that we're having this conversation, and I think that conversation needs to be amplified and replicated. But your question is a slightly different one, and I think that it's interesting that the quote that you're reading too is to also reframe, you know, and reframe both the conversation. Well, maybe we have to initiate a different kind of conversation as well, which celebrates, elevates, amplifies the extraordinary richness of intergenerational conversation. But I'd like to add one other dimension to it, which is I think we tend to focus on intergenerational dynamics in conversation for obvious reasons, tremendously important, and I don't want to suggest it isn't. But I think in its own right, and of course, you know, my focus is on older women, but I think this goes for older people generally, but in its own right, we lose so much in terms of continuity around humanity and experience, in terms of wisdom, not to romanticize it, but just to be serious, the longer you live, there are a lot of experiences that build a certain kind of wisdom and knowing. There's a lot of energy and vigor and thoughtfulness that we lose when we don't have older people in our lives and in our communities and in our society playing critical roles. And so what I'm trying to make a little bit of a distinction around is that it's not just because it's important to have generations interacting with and in dialogue with and passing over to, down to, passing the torch to the next generation, but in their own right, older women, elder women, grandmothers have rich and important lives to lead and important contributions to make. And that's not always just about the intergenerational piece. I never want to sound like I'm dismissing that because I think it's important. But I do find that we have to be careful. I think we have to be cautious that we don't always relate bringing older people and elder women in particular back into the vigorous day-to-day life of thoughts and work and everything else only because it's good in an intergenerational way. Because I think older women in their own right have human rights, have contributions to make. It doesn't always have to be attached to the grandchildren or even to the adult children.
And I think I asked that question in such a way because I think that is a generalization that a lot of people do make. And I apparently fell right into that trap.
But I do too. I find myself doing it too. I have to remind myself as well that, you know, maybe it doesn't always have to be as caregivers or caretakers or generational caregivers.
So can you tell me, you've done so many different things, how you fell into the business of grandmothers? I think I read somewhere that you are in your 50s. Is that correct?
That's right.
So I'm not even sure that you qualify.
Absolutely do not qualify.
as an elder woman, not yet.
Not
You're talking
yet.
To a 77-year-old, so I've earned my stripes.
You certainly
so
have.
I'm curious then how this came about, because obviously at this point in your life it seems to be your passion.
Mm-hmm. It truly is. The genesis of that passion is my deep and edifying relationship with my own maternal grandmother. So that passion started young. I looked up to my mother, who is an exceptional person, exceptional woman in so many ways. And at the same time, the relationship with my grandmother gave me something else. And so from a very young age, that was a very precious understanding of the different kinds of attachment that we can have that supports us through life. Then in a more intentional way, perhaps, a sort of more professional, personal way, that relationship really started in my 40s, maybe even my 30s, when I first started working at the United Nations. I was working at the United Nations Development Fund for Women, and I was quite a young woman. And the women who are mentoring me were in their 50s. Actually, they were the age that I am now. And to me, they seemed like much older women at that age. I think I was 29 when I started at the UN, and they seemed like much, much older women than I. And I realized that as much as I loved my peers and got a lot out of them and from them and being with them, that I was really drawn to these women who were older than I because they had skills and ways of speaking and ways of collaborating and creating community that was just deeply compelling and interesting to me, and I loved it, and I learned so much from them. As I got older, then I started working on HIV and AIDS in Africa. That's another long story, but the route to working with grandmothers in a very concerted and intentional way, and as they call themselves here, grandothers, women of grandmothering age, who will never be, want to be, don't want to be, are not. And that's what grandothers is, sort of a category, and younger women who want to be involved with grandmothers. The grandmothers in Africa were playing a particularly urgent and pivotal role in the life of the continent as AIDS struck. And as young people in their productive years and their reproductive years were dying en masse from AIDS, they were leaving behind millions of children, orphaned children. And so it was the grandmothers who stepped into the breach and who were raising between 2 and 10 children under their roof, grandchildren, grandnieces, great-grandchildren, and were not just having to become mothers again or parents again, but having to raise children who were traumatized by loss. And those grandmothers were, and still are, because they're still at it, and the pandemic continues to unfold, sadly. They came together and they formed support groups, and they started having to figure out ways to support each other to bring an income into the family again. And they were just indomitable and inspiring.
You've talked about a lot of the gifts that you received and that young kids in Africa have received. I think I read somewhere that one of the things about, one of the strengths, one of the gifts that grandmothers give to us and grandfathers as well is proof that life marches on, that bad times are always followed by good times. Am mm-hmm. I remembering that correctly?
Well, yes, some version of that. When the very first podcast interview I ever did as an interviewer, which was very nerve-wracking, was I interviewed my mother. And it was nerve-wracking because my mother, as I said, is a journalist and has spent her life interviewing people and a lot of women. And here I, who am not a professional interviewer, was having the audacity to interview my own mama. But I asked her, we had a wonderful, wonderful conversation. It was the very first podcast I ever published. And at some way toward the end of the podcast or the conversation, I said to her, but there's so many difficult things we're talking about around aging and around the things that you've seen in life and what you've been through and the injustices that you've fought against. You know, what keeps you going? What provides you with hope and succor? And she looked at me and she had a twinkle in her eye. It was a wonderful moment because I was close to the age I am now. It was just a couple of years ago. So I'm an adult and I had yet more to learn from her. She looked at me and she said, there's optimism and survival, honey. And I
love that.
I love it too. And I thought, you know, actually what I've learned most working with older women and grandmothers in Canada and in Africa is that I actually have almost a bizarre jealousy, because I see in the older women that I work with, in Mary Pfeiffer's novel that I love, Women Rowing North, or not novel, book, nonfiction, that there are unbelievable insights you know, the enormous sort of mischievous, there's a lot of impishness, there's a lot of, you know, not giving a damn anymore what anyone thinks. There's a kind of liberatory feeling to a lot of the conversations I've had with older women, where they've shed some of the worries and self-consciousness or anxiety about doing one thing or saying another or appearing this way. So I have a kind of funny, I don't know if jealous is the right word, but I do find myself slightly envious of that moment in life where you employ everything you've learned over the span of a life and you have more freedom. It may not be more freedom in the external environment. I don't want to pretend that that's the case, but some kind of internal liberation that I see in my own mother, who was a feminist her whole life, I see in her older years as she speaks to me that that optimism and survival is something that I don't quite, I can understand it intellectually, Jane, but I don't have it yet in my cells. No.
And do you know that according to recent research that older women are the happiest demographic in the United States?
That doesn't surprise me, right? Because there is something there. I think sometimes I worry that it sounds like I'm romanticizing old age or older women. My mother always says aging isn't for wimps. There are health concerns and aches and pains and losses, but I don't feel like it's romanticizing. I feel like we don't acknowledge enough. And I haven't quite found the right words for this, even though I've been doing this work and thinking about this for a while, Jane. But I think we keep trying to reclaim, I think, in the we, those of us who are thinking about this and talking about it and writing about it, we try to explain and reclaim the richness of old age or aging or being an elder woman. And at the same time, I think that it's hard to find the words because, and I'll just speak for North America and sort of the general sentiment, you know, that we have this cult of the youth, and because of patriarchy, because of gender roles and gender stereotyping, it has never been seen as an added bonus to be an older woman or to be aging. And so I think there is a dynamic tension that's pretty intense in terms of reclaiming a space where the benefits of being an older woman can sometimes outweigh the perceived societal benefits of being a younger woman. And I don't think we're there yet because I don't think anyone will believe it. But I think that's a lovely study that says that older women are the happiest because it forces us to examine that we believe that the happiest time in life has got to be defined by your youth.
I think we can end it on a very happy note. I am so delighted that you took this time with me. I am honored. I know I don't like to, you know, lead with that or end with that, but it's been a fascinating conversation, and I hope we can have more in the future.
Yes, absolutely. And congratulations on this podcast. I don't think we can have enough. And as you say, I'm not even an honorary elder woman yet, so I defer to your greater knowledge, and I'm so looking forward to listening to your conversations and what you bring that I have yet to learn, Jane. So thank you. I'm the one who feels honored.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Adios.
Okay. Thanks so much, Jane. Be well.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Older Women and Friends. And speaking of friends, please tell yours. And if you're interested in reaching me with comments or suggestions, you can do that by emailing me at olderwomenandfriendspodcast@gmail.com. Or you can check out my blog at 70andme.com, and that's 70, the letter N, me, 70andme.com. Until next time.